He's not Richard Nixon. He will say the government's illegitimate and make trouble. That's why if they're going to impeach him, they need to have a plan to indict him, convict him, and send him to prison. And there are so many crimes Donald Trump has committed. Most successful major criminals never get arrested. Donald Trump is a man who's twice had trials for income tax fraud, civil. He lost them both. He's confessed to sales tax fraud. He spent years deeply, deeply entangled with a major cocaine trafficker in ways that make no sense unless they were in business together.
Well, we're going to leave it there. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration's Doing to America. I'm Amy Goodman with Nirmeet Shah.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KABU in Portland. This class will explore hip-hop history locally and nationally, KABU hip-hop programming, how hip-hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme writing and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip-Hop Past, Present, and Future and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KABU, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you say that you wanted more people coming from Norway? Is that true, Mr. President?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I want them to come in from everywhere. Everywhere. Thank you very much, everybody.
Just Caucasian or white countries, sir? Or do you want people to come in from other parts of the world? Whether
Jim, thank you. Jim, thank you.
As President Donald Trump ordering reporters out of a White House room on Tuesday, as one journalist asked about Trump's reported private statement last week suggesting a preference for immigrants from Norway rather than African countries and Haiti. The controversy is part of what seems to be deteriorating negotiations over how to handle the potential expiration of deportation protections for so-called dreamers. And this comes as the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting today that U.S. immigration officials are preparing for major immigration raids throughout the Bay Area and so-called sanctuary cities. Immigration is looking to be the big issue of 2018. So today we're going to dive in to all of these stories and try to clarify the debate on Capitol Hill. Our guest is Kathy Tuktukian. She is the executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. That's next on Letters and Politics.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:02.
But first, the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Hardline conservatives are threatening to scuttle Republican leaders' plans to prevent a weekend government shutdown, saying GOP leaders now lack the votes to push their proposal through the House. The setback comes as a deal between President Trump and Congress to protect young immigrants from deportation also remains distant. Connecticut Democrat Senator Richard Blumenthal says a bipartisan agreement is within reach.
This kind of kicking the can down the road, we've done these continuing resolutions that are stopgap, temporary, short-term, no way to govern, and the Republicans can make a choice now to put it on the president's desk. The vast majority of Congress would be in favor of this bipartisan consensus.
Republican leaders are racing against a Friday deadline for pushing a short-term spending bill through Congress. If they fail, federal agencies will start shutting their doors over the weekend, an election year debacle that GOP leaders and many Democrats are eager to avoid. North Carolina Representative Mark Meadows, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, says its members want added money for the military in the short-term spending bill. Democrats want protection for DACA recipients before a deal can be struck. The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee is accusing President Trump's White House of placing a gag order on former chief strategist Steve Bannon, barring him from answering many questions as part of the panel's investigation into Russian election interference. Representative Adam Schiff of California told MSNBC that Bannon refused to answer questions about his time in the White House or his work on the presidential transition.
This is a essential global gag rule when it comes to anything during the transition, anything during the White House, and a lot that happened after the White House. That's never going to fly with a special counsel. It shouldn't fly with us. I don't think it's going to fly with us.
Special counsel Robert Mueller has subpoenaed Bannon to testify before a grand jury on his role in the White House transition team as part of the special counsel's probe into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is receiving the Congressional Gold Medal. The Kansas Republican, a decorated World War II veteran and his party's 1996 presidential candidate, will receive Congress's highest honor during a ceremony in the Capitol Rotunda today. President Trump plans to attend. Some of the award's 300 recipients include George Washington and Mother Teresa. Dole is considered one of his party's best dealmakers, a distinction Trump has given himself as well. But Trump and the Republican-led Congress are currently mired in a pitched budget battle that could end in a government shutdown at the end of the week if not resolved. Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake harshly criticized President Trump's use of the terms fake news and enemy of the people to refer to the press today in an address on the Senate floor. Flake said Trump's rhetoric is reminiscent of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin.
It is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase enemy of the people that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, annihilating such individuals, unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader.
The White House had no immediate comment. Flake has said he is not comparing Trump to Stalin, who was responsible for the deaths of millions, but said Trump's use of a term favored by Stalin is chilling. Coal industry interests are suing in federal court to overturn the city of Oakland's ban on coal shipments at the Port of Oakland. The plaintiffs say the ban doesn't take the industry's new safety measures into account and violates federal law. Backers of the ban say it helps protect the West Oakland community from environmental health hazards. Christopher Martinez reports.
In 2016, the Oakland City Council passed an ordinance banning coal shipments because of concerns over the health effects in an already environmentally troubled West Oakland community near the rail yard. The developer of the proposed coal shipment facility, Phil Tagami, sued Oakland, saying the city's ban is unconstitutional. He testified on the first day of the trial Tuesday. Lawyers for the plaintiffs also challenged the city's environmental review, calling it a sham that ignores evidence about the safety of the proposed new coal terminal. The city has drawn support from environmental groups like the Sierra Club and San Francisco Baykeeper, as well as the California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Opponents of the ban have funneled money into the plaintiff's lawsuit, with major funding coming from Kentucky oil companies. Opponents of a coal terminal say the project would release dangerous coal dust, harming people in West Oakland who already suffer from high rates of asthma and other health problems. Plaintiffs say the Oakland ban harms a project that would comply with air quality and other environmental rules by using new, safe technologies. The lawsuit will continue into next week. Reporting from the Federal Courthouse in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. The San Francisco Chronicle reported today that, quote, U.S. immigration officials have begun preparing for a major sweep in San Francisco and other Northern California cities, which federal officers would look to arrest more than 1,500 undocumented people while sending a message that immigration policy will be enforced in the sanctuary state. The Chronicle cited unnamed sources that it said were close to the operation. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, negotiations discussions over a bipartisan compromise to provide further deportation protections under the program commonly referred to as acronym of DACA in exchange for further so-called border security and other changes to immigration policy appear to have deteriorated. President Trump ordered the end of the Obama-era policy that protected undocumented immigrants who came to this country at a young age. However, a federal judge in San Francisco has put a stay on Trump's order until the legal issues around the case are decided by a court, and that will probably be the Supreme Court sometime down the road. President Donald Trump made immigration the top issue in his presidential campaign, and it looks to be shaping up that it could be the big issue of 2018. Now that repeal and replace of Obamacare has failed, and well, tax cuts are out of the way. So today, we're looking to have a wide-ranging conversation on immigration and what's happening with all this stuff. Joining me here in the studio is Kathy Tuck-Tuckin. She is the executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Kathy Tuck-Tuckin, as always, always a good pleasure to see you. We were saying earlier, though, we never see each other under great conditions.
That's right. One of these days, Mitch. One of these days. Hope it's soon.
Well, it's a bit. I hope so too. Let's start on this story in the San Francisco Chronicle. Here's another quote from it. The operation would go after people who have been identified as targets for deportation, including those who have been served with final deportation orders and those with criminal histories, the source said. The number could tick up if officers come across other undocumented immigrants in the course of their actions and make what are known as collateral arrests. What is your take, what we are seeing being reported today by the San Francisco Chronicle?
Well, this is a targeted arrest sweep here in Northern California. This has been taking place around the country in other areas. There's certainly been an uptick in arrests. And as you noted, when they do these so-called targeted arrests, I think the reports are that more than 75% of the people arrested are these collateral arrests.
75%.
People who happen to be in the same household, even when maybe has even gone to the wrong house, for example, looking for someone.
That has happened.
And, you know, what we're seeing with these arrests, there's an increase in arrests and detentions, not necessarily deportations. They have to process people. So also what we're seeing is an expansion of people in detention, across the board. And these are certainly not even the priorities that we saw under the Obama administration. As you know, President Obama had the reputation of being deporter in chief with record numbers of deportations during his administration. And he had prioritized certain arrests. The Trump administration has made clear that they're essentially going after everyone.
Are my numbers correct in this? I saw a graph that suggested deportation levels are roughly the same under the first year of Donald Trump as they were under Obama, and actually way under the peak of Obama's year of 2013. But as you indicated, arrests are up.
Well, arrests are up.
That's important to understand. You have arrests,
yeah,
you have detention, and then you have deportation.
That's right. And there's, there is a process, there is such as it is, but it means that people are getting thrown into detention. Now, whether they have access to legal counsel, where are they being detained? People are being moved from, their home, what had been their home, to another location and can be held in detention for a long time. And depending on, what their case was, or, is this a person who, their main so-called crime was crossing the border without documents 20 years ago. That's considered a crime. So there's a wide range of so-called offenses, and most of which have to do with not having regular immigration status. Those are the people being thrown into detention.
Detention facilities where people are being held? Are these prisons? What are they? Are they more crowded now than before? Do we have any reports about that?
Well, as you probably know, and I think listeners here know, that there was a big increase in the construction of private detention centers and contracts with local jails in order to hold the large numbers of detainees. I think now we as a policy, maintain over 46,000, 40, I think it's around 45, at least over 45,000 detention beds daily. And, you know, in order to accommodate increases, there's also requests to do more private prison construction. You know, we see people who are picked up, on an immigration violation who end up in federal prisons. So today, over half of the people entering federal prisons are immigrants.
Is that up? Is that abnormal?
Yes, that is up, and that is abnormal, and that's based on this trend of sweeping arrests and detentions.
So again, this story, I believe, came out this morning. It might have came out last night on the website, but I know this morning it's in the paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, about this planned sweep throughout Northern California by ICE, trying to pick. It says it could arrest as many, if not more, than 1,500 people. Is that, when it comes to these type of sweeps, is that a major operation? Is that a big operation?
That's a major operation, and I think it was also reported here. And I knew that our local, you know, congressional members have been pushing back on that, and they recognize that this is also a kind of a targeted attack against California.
That's what Diane
against
Feinstein
the notion
said.
Of this being a sanctuary state, Northern California having, you know, strong sanctuary policies in a number of cities. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, you know, from San Jose, who's a ranking member in the Immigration Subcommittee in the House, and one of our biggest champions, was also pushing back on that, as was Congressman Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee.
So when people hear about this story, what do organizations like your own, the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and many immigrant rights groups throughout the Bay Area, I imagine you have many people in the community hearing about this story and now coming to you asking, well, what do we expect? What do we do?
Oh, I mean, we're a national office here in the Bay Area, but we're getting calls every day from people who, you know, from around the country and locally, who are worried about their situation, worried about someone they know. We also get a lot of calls from people who are calling on someone else's behalf, who's undocumented and who's fearful, or, you know, who has a case. But this is what's taking place around the country. So we've been hearing a lot about what's going on in Congress. But on the ground around the country, there's a lot of organizing being done on these general sweeps, but also on all the individual cases. And so, and I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, every person who's picked up and arrested, there's a chain, you know, of relationships. I shouldn't use that word chain, but they have families, they have coworkers, they have members in the community who care about them, and so it has an impact, you know, on families, on neighborhoods, when something like this happens. And a lot of the organizing is defense work that's taking place around the country.
Now, what do you do if you're worried about this? Well, are there things you could do to protect yourself?
Well, if you're an undocumented immigrant, yes. I mean, I think there's been a lot of outreach among community organizations around by community-based legal organizations. We have a number of great organizations here in the Bay Area that tap into Latino, Asian, African immigrant communities, Middle Eastern communities, who make themselves available, who not only do know your rights work, which is important. People need that. But who are there on the ground to defend people if something does happen. There are steps that people can take to ensure that, for example, you know, their documents, whatever they have, are in place. And it's unfortunate, but people have to do that. They plan ahead, and there are programs that immigrant community members have to do to ensure the safety of their children. What's going to happen to their kids if they're picked up and arrested?
So people have
things in place. They have, you know, set up relationships with relatives or close friends. If anything happens to me, and they have documents that show that this person has authority to take care of their children. Otherwise, children can just be put into foster care. So, you know, when something like this happens, even when it's announced, of course, it throws a lot of fear and concern into the community. It's just very important that there be a lot of proactive, I think, responses on many levels. And, you know, and it just can't be saying that we're going to defend these communities. So I think it's important to give that actual support
And the government is not commenting on the story from San Francisco Chronicle. They're not denying it. They're not confirming it. Not that I saw. I don't know if you saw.
No, I haven't seen anything. But I suspect, because they have made these announcements, that they are going to increase these arrests. And as we know, they're very upset about the so-called sanctuary cities movements. And I think have those in their radar. And certainly
we're now a sanctuary state.
Yeah, sanctuary state.
Does that do anything in this situation?
No, you know, and again, we've pushed back against, you know, just the misunderstanding of what it means to be a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state. It doesn't mean that people cannot be, obviously, arrested, detained, and deported from a city or a state. It means that we're not providing local or state resources to assist in a federal immigration operation. That's what it means.
So it doesn't stop ICE. It may stop local law enforcement from participating in these
actions. It doesn't,
I think... Could local law enforcement agencies in sanctuary cities participate in this?
Well, there's been a lot of pushback. Yeah. Oakland,
you know, that's what I was going to say.
Is certainly one of those cities where Oakland police, did they just happen to be on the street where an ICE operation was taking place, or was their presence actually part of a coordinated effort where there was actual cooperation in violation of city policy? So, you know, but I think it having, you know, the sanctuary movement, I think, has been important in opening doors, in, you know, raising public awareness, giving us some political tools to bring on local elected officials and institutions in defense of immigrant communities. And, you know, globally, there's a whole movement afoot to energize what we call, you know, global cities, that where migrants live. So often in defiance of national policies, which might be more, you know, reactive, global cities recognize, hey, you know, where people live and work in our communities, they are of value. And we see a responsibility for protecting their rights and their right to be here. So San Francisco, New York, there are cities, you know, around the world that are taking those positions, often in defiance and in the face of, you know, repressive national level legislation.
I just think it's important, you know, take a moment just to recognize the gravity of this situation in this moment that we're in, when we have a state that considers itself a sanctuary state. Again, understanding, you know, what do we mean by sanctuary? But nonetheless, the governor signed a bill in October, a growing movement of sanctuary cities, especially here in the Bay Area, but throughout California. Basically, lawmakers, governors, everyone in agreement from the state that we don't want this happening and coming in and terrorizing our community, terrorizing our neighbors, and yet it's about to happen. Or it seems like it's about to happen.
Well,
anyways,
it's about to happen in Northern California. It's been happening in Southern California.
Yeah.
So these arrests, you know, last month, I mean, there have been, you know, series of big sweeps that have been taking place. And again, you know, they make this announcement, people can kind of get ready, you know, we can mobilize and protest against it. But every day these arrests and detentions are taking place, whether it's in the form of this major sweep or not. So when they do these sweeps, it's often a political statement. You know, it's to draw
up. And that's what Dianne Feinstein said in that Chronicle article, that California is being targeted on
this. Yes.
Could that make this illegal? Is there then a legal challenge of saying, wait a minute, you're...
I don't think there's a legal challenge, but certainly there's a political challenge, I think, that can, you know, that we need to make and we should be making. And I'm glad that elected officials are, you know, are stepping up. And, you know, it's also in the face of what's happening. We have local elected officials, you know, I'm so proud of, you know, friend and Assemblyman Rob Bonta, who's out in Washington this week, you know, on the Hill, fighting for Dreamers, fighting for a durable solution for DACA recipients.
Now, we're going to get to that issue here in just one moment. Last question on this issue from the article from the San Francisco Chronicle, again saying that ICE is intending to conduct major sweeps throughout Northern California in the next few weeks. Nothing was specific, but the article, and I quoted this earlier, says that they're going to be going after people who are served with final deportation orders, those with criminal histories, and again, we talked about the whole issue about then collateral arrests. That makes it sound like, to me, what they're going to be doing is going to people's homes?
homes and workplaces, neighborhoods. You know, some of the controversy obviously has been where they appear in neighborhoods, on streets where people are walking their children to school or driving on their way, you know, thoroughfares that go to schools or to certain workplaces, that is going to be part of the sweep. And so again, when they say 1,500, plus the collateral arrests, I mean, we could be looking at over 4,000 people being arrested, and translate that into families, mm-hmm. you know, and communities. Then that's, you know, the number of people who could be affected by this then gets quadrupled.
Is there any common wisdom or protocol people should know about if ICE shows up at your door?
They should know that they need to ask if they have a warrant. They need to show their papers. Hopefully people are already in touch with and have established a connection with a trusted legal resource. And a lot of our, you know, locally, whether it's La Raza, Centro Legal, you know, Centro Legal de La Raza, Carecen, you know, Asian Law Caucus, a number of our legal support organizations, you know, will provide, you know, clear information, instruction on what to do in a raid. What are your rights? There are little cards available in many different languages that are very easy to tap. But if someone thinks they're in a particularly vulnerable situation, it would be very important that they already be in touch with a trusted legal resource and make that case known.
So if you are a person who may be in a vulnerable situation, get in touch with
absolutely,
people.
Absolutely. Don't wait till the last minute. We get, as I mentioned to you, we get calls from friends, other family members of people who were suddenly swept up and had no legal backup. No, they did not know who to call.
Yeah.
And those resources are there. And there's some great, you know, just online available where you can find who to go to, who to call. And that's frustrating. And most people are, you know, busy and they're not necessarily going to do that, but it is important.
We are in conversation with Kathy Tuck-Tuckin. She's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And we are talking, we're pretty much having a wide-ranging conversation about immigration. And I do want to get to what's happening on Capitol Hill. Well, the government could potentially shut down by the end of this week. If you think if the government were to shut down, they could move forward with these sweeps?
Well, that's a good question.
Because usually
Mitch,
it's sort of emergency services.
Right. Yeah, this might not be considered an emergency.
Yeah, that's right. Everything else seems to shut down except
that's
for
a
emergency
good question.
Services.
That's a good question. I'll have to research that one.
Let me know what you find out about that one. You may want to let the Democratic lawmakers on the Hill know about that one, too.
Right.
So the reason the government may shut down by the end of this week after Friday is because the current continuing resolution, which we've been in this cycle of not being, you know, lawmakers not being able to come up with a new budget. So what they do is they pass what we call continuing resolutions that keep the government funded at just the previous levels. Democrats have used this now because, political wisdom here would suggest Republicans would be in a lot of trouble if the government were to shut down, considering they have the White House and all of Congress. So Democrats have tried to use this moment to try to negotiate a plan with the president concerning people that are protected under DACA protections. We're talking about people who came to this country at a very young age or undocumented, but basically grown up here or in school and doing all of those things. Donald, that was a President Obama order during his tenure. President Trump and his Justice Department have said that that order was unconstitutional, even though it had yet to be decided by the courts if it was, and had announced that by March that it would be expiring those protections. That's all up in the courts right now. We'll get into the courts in a moment. So it appeared last week for a moment that there was a bipartisan deal that would have included issues around, quote unquote, border security, also changing some things about legal immigration, perhaps a wall. We can get into that in exchange for providing some close to 800,000 people deportation protections who are covered under DACA. That fell apart. It appears like it fell apart
After Republicans in the House really objected to this potential bipartisan deal. And then we got the whole issue about Donald Trump calling countries in Africa and Haiti an expletive hole. I'll just put it that way. I guess we can say it now on radio, but Kathy, for 17 years, I've never said an expletive on the radio. And for some reason, I say them all the time out off of the air, but I'm just not into it right now. And not only that, believe me, Pacifica cannot afford another lawsuit. So anyways, the government may now shut down, but it looks like the immigration issue is now off the table. And now Republicans are coming with another proposal to attach what's called the CHIP program, which provides health insurance for 9 million low-income children instead, and trying to get Democrats to vote for that. So there's a big issue of what's going to happen there. Before I get to any specifics, anything you want to piggyback off there?
Oh, well, just how ugly it is that we are holding the most vulnerable people hostage to of horrendous, proposals, and including in this budget, that are just going to hurt people more.
Yeah. I mean, how many hostages do we have? I mean, we're just finding all kinds of hostages.
It's totally sad. And I hope there's lots of pushback against that. That's just incredibly mean-spirited and what can we say?
It comes to a head on Friday. I'm hearing many political pundits say the immigration issue is off the table, but I've been following politics to know that anything can happen at the last minute. You vote for this, I'll throw in this, boom, we got a deal. That happens all the time. What is your take on this, what we saw as this bipartisan proposal that was coming from Democrat Richard Durbin of Illinois and Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina?
Like you, I don't know that it's entirely dead, but I think the idea that you could negotiate pretty complicated agreements on, an immigration bill as part of a more complicated spending bill now by Friday is looking to be untenable. But I don't think anything's ever dead. And, yesterday there was a new proposal introduced in the House, Congressman, bipartisan immigration bill, Heard and Aguilar out of Texas. And it's similar, I think, in some ways. I haven't read all of the details, but I think it has similar characteristics to what Durbin and Graham were proposing. And they claim that they have, growing support in the House for that. But again, whether that can be moved forward. So there are a lot of variables.
There's a competing message by Bob Goodlatte, a Republican, has all the security stuff, none of the
right
protections.
He has nothing positive to contribute. I would think that, the Heard-Aguilar bill would, certainly have much more traction towards a resolution. It's something that the Republicans can bite into, and it does include, elements of the DREAM Act in it. We're never completely happy with all of these kind of compromise bills, but it's a vehicle to have that kind of conversation and debate that does bring in those elements. So you can't quite, can't dismiss it.
Is it a fair trade to say, okay, recognizing you're going to, this is a Republican-controlled Congress, you have a Republican in president, is this a fair trade, recognizing you need Republicans on this to say, we will accept this amount of what, they call border security and changes the immigration for the protection of these people who are protected under DACA?
Well, I think when you get to the stage, when it comes down to the wire, we are always going to advocate for rights-based principles and policies, and that's our standard. And then when you look at the actual legislation, and when it gets down the wire, you have to look at, does this have any red lines? Does this have anything that's totally unacceptable? And take into consideration all of those. So we've not taken a position on this yet. I know our colleagues in the Southern Border Communities Coalition that have been in Washington the last 2 to 3 weeks since the beginning of the year, working on bringing awareness about from and perspectives from border communities to Congress, knowing that that's going to be the trade-off for any DACA resolution. They've been working closely with Dreamers and the United We Dream, other organizations working for a DACA solution have been very clear. They don't support a trade-off that is going to throw border communities under the bus in principle. And I think everyone's going to be looking at this legislation to see if this is fair. Nothing's ever, I don't like to say it's a fair exchange. And I think this problem in Washington where you are always looking at a zero-sum game, you're going to have to give up something to get something. It's the carrot and the stick is a sad commentary because it does not produce good policy.
Republicans say in this debate that if we don't do what they call border security, other people call it militarization of the border, building the wall, if you don't do those things, even if we do a fair and humane immigration reform right now, you're just going to end up with the same problem 5, 10, 15 years from now. Is that fair?
No. Mm-hmm. There is a bigger discussion globally about the role of border enforcement, border management in the context of how you address global migration. So one, in the long run, you have to look at, all the factors that drive migration. You have to look at, what we call forced migration. Why are people moving from their homes in the first place? But, that requires long-term solutions. So in the meantime, should we be punishing people who need to cross borders, who don't have access to visas, where legislation, program, policies are not in place to provide for legal passage as workers, as migrants or as refugees or asylum seekers? And those are huge, huge gaps in the world today. So it's not just a U.S. problem. But I think we've also seen that, border walls, borders themselves, frankly, do not stop people from moving across borders. It creates certain barriers. It causes them to lose their rights. As we've seen at the U.S.-Mexico border, stronger border enforcement has actually increased border deaths, even though there are fewer migrants crossing the border for lots of different reasons, and not just due to increased enforcement. So that as a framework is, it's throwing, good money after bad. There is need for better border management and regulation. We could certainly, ports of entry in the U.S., how things are facilitated. We recognize that, Mexico is a huge trading partner for California and the whole country. And there could certainly be better border management, and there are resources that can go into that. What's done that respects human rights, that in respects environmental protections. The environmental groups along the border in recent weeks have been very active and very clear in identifying what the problems are in the increased border enforcement, the construction of the wall, and those types of barriers and the impact that will have on the environment. And in the end, it's certainly not going to stop forced migration or undocumented migration. So those are long-term solutions, but we need to engage in that as well. And a lot of these short-term proposals on border enforcement, a lot of it is to, is appealing to a base. It's appealing to, it's not delineating border security from immigration. It's making an unfortunate link that does not need and should not be made.
Should there be border security?
I think, our position has always been that, countries certainly have the right to manage their borders. And I think but that said, again, it should be done in a humane and fair process. We were involved for a number of years in working with the UN to put together a set of principles and guidelines for countries concerning human rights at international borders. Very reasonable, and it respects that right of sovereign countries to govern their borders. But it's one question to govern a border, and it's another to try to impose these kinds of controls against immigration. So those are two different things. And we fail on the border governance side seriously.
Let's talk about some of these issues within what seem to be the bipartisan deal, and if there is a deal on DACA. And again, it's unclear. I mean, if you are one of these people that are protected under DACA or related to somebody who's protected under DACA, it's such a difficult situation to be in, because right now, again, a court has ruled, put a stay on the ending of this program while it the issue itself makes its way through the courts. And basically, the judge was saying, you know, it'd be irreparable harm if the courts were to rule against Donald Trump on this, and yet all these people, you know, were adversely affected because of it. The Trump administration is appealing that stay, so we'll see what happens there. That could, you know, be overturned here in a short period of time. The Trump administration, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, is actually asking the Supreme Court to actually bypass much of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in this and just go straight to the Supreme Court and hear it immediately. So we don't really know what's going to happen, but at least right now, you know, we don't know if this March deadline is really going to come, especially if none of these decisions are made. But again, we just don't know. But these other issues we're hearing attached to DACA in exchange for a DACA, and depending on how you view the issue, we have different terms for them. One is ending what I think you would probably call family-based immigration. The Republicans call it chain
migration.
Migration. Same thing. We're talking about the same thing here.
Yeah.
Right. What is it?
We are. U.S. immigration policy since 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act, was passed, created family immigration, which has been the cornerstone of immigration policy since then. And when that was established, it was a pushback against previous racial quotas which existed in the country. It was still based on people being able to petition and migrate on the basis of having family members here. And actually, at the time, they thought there would be more European immigrants. But why are Europeans needing to come to the United States? It increased very visibly immigration from Latin America and from Asia. And there was, you know, within a decade after that, by 1975, there were calls for mass deportations and, you know, people not liking to see this change in demographic, you know, demographic revolution that has certainly taken place since then, you know, largely due to those changes. And, you know, I think we've talked a lot about some of the problems and flaws in that program. There are huge backlogs of people who really don't get in. So despite the Trump administration latching onto this term chain migration to make it appear that, you know, one person gets here and suddenly there's 50 more people here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the image.
It doesn't really work like that, you know.
Yeah.
There's more, you know, immediate relatives who come, and if you actually look at the figures of who comes by category, it's very little. And there are some countries with such a backlog, they're waiting 2 decades. They're in line for 2 decades. And that actually accounts for some people who come here who are undocumented. They're not just someone who came out of the blue. They actually have family members here, and they had exhausted any possibility of coming here to be reunited through regular
channels. I imagine many
channels.
Undocumented immigrants already have family here.
Oh, yeah,
hard to go somewhere where you
absolutely
know no one at all.
Well, yeah, that is certainly part of it. It is part of the family reunification process. That's what undocumented migration does also represent.
Now Trump and the Republicans as well seem to want to change it and take it away from family-based immigration to merit-based,
right,
where you show you can make an economic impact once you get here running.
Right. And they've said that from the beginning. And you know, Trump had campaigned on that. We want merit-based immigration. And, you know, it's a slap in the face to everyone who does come here, you know, on family membership. It's like, well, these are all deadbeats, or, oh, heavens, they're old people. You know, they're not productive. I mean, that's what it's saying. But most people who come here through family-based immigration are also productive members of society. Are we then just turning away grandparents? Is that going to be the policy? I think there is, when we look at immigration policy, there probably is, and in the immigrant rights movement, continue to have this discussion on, the ways in which people migrate. And there is an issue of employment-based immigration that exists. Many people migrate to work. So how can we facilitate that and ensure that actually people have rights, that they're not just migrating as temporary workers? So there is a discussion that should be had about employment-based visas. So that doesn't mean that's off the table, but we should not be doing that at the expense of just a punitive policy that's going to separate families and deny their unification.
Again, we are in conversation with Kathy Tuktukin. She's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And we are talking about really many issues around immigration still to come. We still have to get to TPS here. But before we do that, I want to bring up another issue about that's being talked about on Capitol Hill and also in the news. And it's another issue that, depending on what side you are, you have a different term for it. I imagine you would call it the diversity visa program, whereas Trump would call it the lottery program.
Right.
What is that?
So the diversity visa was established in 1990. And interestingly, the proponents of that we're using it to increase Irish immigration, and it allows 50,000, I think it's 50,000 a year through a program to enter from countries that don't have, established patterns of migration into the U.S. So, it's to diversify, to create a greater mix of people who have access to come. Now, the way it's described by the Trump administration, it would appear that and he also said that countries are choosing their worst, that they countries are, have some list of violent, offenders, and they put their names into a big fishbowl, and they're picked out of that fishbowl, and they can come to the United States, and that's so far from.
Didn't Jeff Sessions
truth.
Say something similar to that?
They're sending their worst people
who are sending their illiterate, uneducated.
Right, and countries, first of all, they don't choose people, so a system is set up. You apply, you get vetted. It's just like any other program. So you have to meet certain criteria. You don't just get like a free pass to come in. And it's up to 50,000 people. It's not a lot of people. But what it means, because they've thrown this into the mix, it has become part of the bipartisan bill proposals. So I think the Graham Durbin proposal would end the visa, the diversity visa program, and it would split up the 50,000 visas, still allow 25,000 for people to come from underrepresented countries, and the other half would go towards addressing TPS holders who would lose their status and could apply. Through that means.
So there could be hope for
but it's
proposal.
It's a relatively small number when we talk about all of the hundreds of thousands of TPS holders who may lose their status in the next couple of years.
200,000 Salvadorans?
More than, yeah. I mean, it's, probably in total, over 400,000 people if we're looking at all of the TPS holders.
For 50,000 Haitians?
Yeah.
Nicaraguans.
Right. Nicaraguans, Hondurans, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with that. They've, smaller numbers of people from from African countries, but, still a good number.
And we're talking about TPS. That stands for Temporary Protection Status.
Protected status.
Protective status that people received because something happened to their home country. El Salvador was earthquake.
Haiti was an earthquake and
usually
also a storm.
Natural disasters or, you know, kind of urgent, chaotic situations, political situations
what
in
happens.
Countries.
And the Trump administration has announced the end of these protections for 200,000 Salvadorans, 50,000 Haitians, as you indicated, up to 400,000 people altogether. And they now have, a year and a half or so to,
yeah, they've
to
not
leave
made
the country?
All,
or,
yeah, they've not made all the determinations, but we're expecting that they're just going to go down the list and say, no, we're not going to renew them, and you have 18 months to get your things in order is what they're saying. So, you know, so the departure date, you know, would be in 2019 for some groups.
I have wondered with this whole controversy, and again, we don't have Trump saying it on tape. We just have secondhand sources telling us that Trump, during last week's meeting over immigration that fell apart, that he was calling African nations and also Haiti S-holes. It's been said enough. I think people know what I'm talking about. That made me wonder something, though. And when we've seen the legal challenges to the travel ban, keeping people from particular Muslim countries from coming to the United States. In the legal challenge of this, we've seen the issue arise of animus of the law. In other words, there is some dislike or discrimination or fear of a person or a group of people that you have that is driving you to make these policies. So with the travel ban, they were looking at Trump's past statements in his campaign about Muslims to say there's animus in the law. He had animus towards these people, and that should nullify his decision. I wonder about the TPS issue and the fact that, you know, I don't know if he said El Salvador, but El Salvador keeps coming up in the conversation over who he's considering S-hole countries. I almost wonder if that same argument can be used with this TPS, because I'm sure there's going to be legal challenges to this.
Right, and it's, yeah, well, certainly a good point. And if it hasn't been used, I hope that that is brought into it, you know, if not in the legal challenges, just in the, I think, in the pushback. So when you know, because the State Department has to authorize that these countries can now, are safe enough, and they've recovered enough from whatever disaster had taken place that they can accept, you know, people back into the country. And how anyone in their right mind can justify that Haiti is in a situation where it can accept people, where right. The situation in El Salvador, you know, the most violent country in the world, is in a position where it can accept, people, you know, former TPS holders from the United States. So
I remember seeing the language, especially for Haiti, saying that, okay, Haiti's better off now.
Yeah.
They can take these people back. And then if you turn around and you call them S-hole countries.
Well, and in contrast to say, I mean, and it wasn't just a comment that we could use more people from Norway. From reports in that same meeting, he said, yeah, we could use more people from Europe. And I think even though there's a demographic change in Europe as well, I think he's talking about white Europeans. We could use more of those, you know, coming into the United States. So, I mean, it falls in line, you know, and you would just have to be like kind of just ignoring completely what's, all of the news, not to accept that Donald Trump's racist views absolutely play into all of the policy decisions he's made specifically around immigration, and also targeting a group which, to his base, where he also plays into kind of a nationalistic fervor and that intersection of race and nationalism, that he sees them as very vulnerable. And, you know, we were just commenting on this earlier, but I think it is interesting that I don't think he's necessarily expanding his base with these messages. And from what we've seen, there's a decrease in support from every single category, including those that he has traditionally relied upon. So my hope is that, you know, over the long time, you know, there we are, this is on, you know, in the trash bin of history, and he certainly is on the wrong side of history, and that what we are doing, even as we take on these really ugly often media-generated battles, is changing the narrative on race and immigration. And, you know, in the future, these kinds of proposals are not going to be met with the same kind of fervor that he used in his campaign. I mean, you know, his phrase of build the wall was just a euphemism for, you know, kick these immigrants out.
Right. Race and immigration is an important issue here. Race and immigration has a long history together.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That was supposed to have been undone by, what, the 1965
Well, these are the laws, you know, and that 65 Act, and we were reminding people on Martin Luther King Day that the change in that law, you know, time of war on poverty and the Civil Rights Act, that that did not take
Voting
place.
Voting Rights Act. They're all, these are all together.
It did not take place in a vacuum.
Yeah.
So absolutely, the environment of the Civil Rights Movement affected and the support behind the change in the 65 Act and doing away with the racial quotas. Absolutely.
Yeah. I almost couldn't help but wonder, and I haven't heard anyone else say this, and maybe I'm taking too big of a leap here, but when Donald Trump said, why aren't we accepting more people from Norway, I almost wondered if that was a nod towards white supremacy in the way of, you know, Nordic religion, mythology is really popular amongst white nationalist groups. I'm interested in it, too. I don't think you have to be a racist to appreciate it. But they really are, you know, Wotan and Thor and all this stuff. So I almost wondered if that was a little nod over there. But
yeah, well, you can't put past anything, you know, past Donald Trump. And even these comments that he appears to make off the cuff are often very purposeful.
This seems like a difficult time right now, especially for immigrants. Do you see a light at the end of this tunnel? We talked a little bit about this actually before we became on air. Could there be such a swing to the other side against Donald Trump, against what Donald Trump stands for? You indicated, you know, this rhetoric doesn't seem to be growing his base. If anything, it's decreasing it, even though feeding into a very active base that he has. Could we get to a point where this actually swings so far to the other side? We could get some type of reform that you would think is fair, which is also difficult because we've been having this conversation for a really long time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we will always fight for something that's fair, but politics is politics. And passing legislation, you know, even with changes, for example, in Congress out of the midterm elections, maybe a change in the White House in 2020, unfortunately, politicians will tend to follow a blueprint of what was previously introduced. And we've seen in previous attempts to pass so-called comprehensive immigration reform legislation, those have been sometimes really ugly compromises, but those tend to set the standard, and then you kind of work from there. Could there be an improvement? Hopefully, and I think that's what we would, you know, we would fight for. But all of these kinds of changes, you know, are, you know, could certainly be possible, and I think that's why it's going to be very important around the midterm elections to do the kind of education, organizing, and mobilizing.
Are you seeing that mobilization happening within immigrant communities? I want to be careful here because there'll probably be some people from the right if they were to hear a conversation. Yeah. Like, see, they're going to be sending these undocumented people to go vote, which of course they cannot.
No, but you know, I think we've seen a pattern. We were really, you know, proud to help found the Mobilized Immigrant Vote here in California, you know, years ago, because we saw and recognized the need for organizing among immigrant communities, not just to have an electoral vote, but just to participate civically, which obviously they have been doing.
That's right.
Look at the Dreamers. They have been some of the best advocates and policy advocates, and they don't have, you know, they are undocumented, even if they have DACA. We know that there's that possibility. There is demographic change. Immigrants that we've saw an uptick in naturalization. People want to vote, so they want to be part of this process and have that voice in the electoral arena as well. And if there are changes in the House, you know, possibly in the Senate, in the 2018 midterms, you know, we might see proposals come back around in the spring of 2019. But as we saw in the last election, campaigning for the president begins really early, like a year and a half in advance, and it affects everything that goes on in Congress. And that's why we saw a lot of the impasse on a lot of issues. You know, people are looking at what are the vulnerable issues, what's going to, you know, affect their base, what's going to vote their, you know, affect their electability or reelectability. So those will also be dynamics. But I do think there is a changed conversation. As I was saying, I could not have imagined the conversation that's happening now, the pushback against this a spending bill that does not include DACA. When the DREAM Act was first introduced in the early 2000s, that we couldn't have imagined that it would have gained the credibility and support that it has now, that you would even see that voiced. Whether they follow through with it, whether the Democrats are going to follow through on their threat, remains to be seen.
Do you think Democrats should not vote for a spending bill this week?
They have said that they will not, and if they intend to keep up their leverage around DACA,
even with CHIP,
I think they will.
Or,
you know, there's going to be a spending bill.
Yeah,
it's a question of when it's going to happen.
I mean, I imagine there are immigrants who are helped by CHIP.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, across the board. And that's why I said, yeah, what an ugly thing and mean-spirited thing to do, to hold CHIP recipients, you know, hostage to this. And I know they're trying to peel away Democrats on this, and I think they are beginning to do that.
It's hard for Democrats not to vote for this.
But that is the leverage. The thing is, there is going to be a spending bill.
But it would only be for a month.
Yeah.
My
understanding.
You get back to it mid-February.
Mid-February.
If the court's decision to stay the decision on DACA holds.
Right. And,
but again, that's the hard part.
But do you have a month? Can they move any of these bipartisan bills in a month on DACA? So that's the other issue. And that's all before the March 5th deadline for DACA, when the program formally ends, supposedly.
Kathy Tuck-Tuckin, that was wonderful. Thank you. Always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Kathy Tuck-Tuckin is Executive Director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. She has joined us for a conversation on immigration. And Kathy, quickly, tell me about this event coming up. We have about 10 seconds.
All right. We'd love for people to go to an event, People on the Move, Thursday, January 25th, 6 p.m. at the Washington Inn Hotel. It's based on a great report out of UC Berkeley on why people are migrating today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Have you heard?
KBOO hosts Beloved Community in Action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. In January, we'll show the movie The Mask You Live In, a documentary that follows boys and young men as they struggle to stay true to themselves while negotiating America's narrow definition of masculinity. Again, that's a screening of The Mask You Live In for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, January 18th at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.